The following is a rebroadcast of Studio Tulsa. This program first aired last year.
Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. The human brain is almost unfathomably complex. It regulates our bodies, it's the hub of our senses, it handles our metabolism, and is the manufacturer and repository of our thoughts. Understanding how all of this works is daunting, which is why scientists and writers who can effectively communicate our progress in understanding brain science are few and far between. We're lucky to have one of the great ones with us here today. Lisa Felbin Barrett is University Distinguished Professor of Psychology and Neuroscience at Northeastern University in Boston. Her first book, How Emotions Are Made, is a tour de force explaining the science behind how our emotions are constructed from neurochemicals and how our actions can influence them. She gave a TED Talk about it titled, You Aren't at the Mercy of Your Emotions, Your Brain Creates Them, in December 2017 that has had almost 6 million views. Her new book, just out from Houghton Mifflin Harcourt, is titled 7.5 Lessons About the Brain. It's a series of short essays about the brain, written in conversational language that is both entertaining and highly enlightening. It's a delightful read that will deepen your understanding of how our brains work and how we got this way. Lisa Felbin Barrett, author of 7.5 Lessons About the Brain, is my guest today on Studio Tulsa Medical Monday. Dr. Lisa Felbin Barrett, welcome to Medical Monday. I'd like to start by just having you tell us about the word allostasis, which is something I'd never heard of before. And though that's a scientific-sounding word, I have to say this book is a pleasure to read and very easy and definitely for the lay public. In fact, on your website, it says it's the world's first neuroscience beach read. And so this is one of the few technical terms. But your argument is that our brains handle allostasis, which was a new concept for me. But our brains are not necessarily for thinking, as your introduction says.
Yeah, thanks so much. First, thanks for having me on your program. I wrote the book really to introduce some basic neuroscience findings, maybe some findings that about the brain and its constant conversation with the body that people are largely unaware of, but that are not part of the popular conversation about brains and bodies, but that would lead people to think about themselves and their lives maybe a little bit differently. And allostasis is one of these terrific concepts. There's a lot of research to suggest that brains did not evolve to think, right? So the brain evolution is not on some upward trajectory from lower animals to higher thinking animals with, you know, humans at the top. Instead, the evidence suggests, from evolutionary and developmental neurobiology, the evidence suggests that the most important job that your brain has is to control the systems of your body, and that your brain is wired. In fact, all brains appear to be wired, all brains that have been studied anyways, appear to be wired to function predictively. So allostasis, this complicated word, really means that your brain is running a model of what's going on inside your body, and it's attempting to predict the needs of your body and meet those needs before they arise. And the way that I explain it, the metaphor that we can use, is that your brain is running a budget for your body. So your brain isn't budgeting money, it's budgeting salt and glucose and water and oxygen and all of the nutrients that your brain needs to ensure that the cells of your body get to keep your body alive and well. And so you could think about your brain as kind of the financial office of a multinational company, because you have many, many, many systems inside your body. You know, you have a cardiovascular system for, you know, your heart and blood and so on. I don't have to explain this to your audience. You know, they know what a cardiovascular system is, a respiratory system, an immune system, and so on and so forth. And so the concept of allostasis was really introduced in contrast to homeostasis. So there's an old idea of that each system in your body has a set point and that it's like a temperature gauge and that you're, you know, the systems are attempting to get to a set point. And the concept of allostasis, really, the evidence suggests, is not really about getting to a set point. It's about running the system in the most metabolically efficient way. So even when you're running on a treadmill, you know, or working really hard, that is, there's a lot of metabolic output, you know, there are efficient ways to do it and not so efficient ways to do it. And so the goal is to predict in advance what the body's going to need and then attempt to meet those needs so that before they arise, so that the nutrients and so on are there when the system needs it, because that's the most metabolically efficient way to run a body.
So it's a bit of debunking, because we definitely have put ourselves, humans, that is, at the center of the narrative that we have. I think there's a very prevalent belief that evolution has, in fact, moved inexorably toward this idea of thought or rational thought. And you make the counterclaim, in a sense, that really what our brains have evolved to do is to provide resources to our different body systems as efficiently as possible. Another myth that you debunk is the so-called, I guess, triune brain. I wasn't familiar with that term, but I was definitely familiar with the concept. Can you explain what that is and how you, in fact, say it's a myth?
Sure. Well, I mean, I should point out that it's not my research which shows that it's a myth. I'm reporting on other people's research, in fact, decades of research, because it's been known really since the 1970s, I would say, that the triune brain is a myth and that your brain didn't really evolve that way. So the triune brain idea is the idea that your brain evolves in three parts, that you have an inner kind of lizard brain that evolved to deal with instincts like feeding, fighting, fleeing, and reproduction, the four Fs as it's called, and that around this brain evolved a second layer, which we share with ancient mammals, or that comes from ancient mammals, which is called the limbic system, limbic for border. And these are supposedly regions that border your inner lizard, and that a scientist assigned the function of emotionality. And then your neocortex, or new cortex, which supposedly houses the human capacity for rationality. And this idea that you have a three-layered brain, that and that brain evolution preceded, you know, like increasing layers of sedimentary rock, or as I prefer to call it, you know, describe it like where your neocortex is thought to have evolved like icing on an already baked cake, you know, your inner beast of your inner lizard and your limbic system. It's a complete myth. When you look at the brains of various animals, vertebrates, with the naked eye, it looks as if a lizard doesn't really have a cerebral cortex, or it has a very, very small one, and that the cerebral cortex is very, very large in humans. But in fact, when you peer into the workings of neurons and look at their molecular structure, and in particular look at their genetic structure, you can see that nothing like the triune brain occurred in brain evolution, that all the brains of mammals that have ever been studied show that mammals share a common brain plan, actually. And the genetic analysis suggests that even lizards and jawed fish and birds all share a common brain plan with mammals. So there are, I think, 271 steps in the development of a brain from an embryo to a fully grown brain, and those steps occur in all the, I mean, it's really only been mammals that have been studied but so far, but that all of the steps occur in exactly the same order. So basically, and what makes brains look different is that the duration or the time that each stage runs changes. So you have exactly the same neurons, exactly the same types of neurons as a bird, as, you know, any lizard. It's just that as brains get larger, they reorganize, and therefore their parts, you know, can look different, but the actual neurons themselves are the same.
You mentioned how our brains may not functionally be all that different from what we would consider lesser animals, lesser mammals or reptiles, for example, the so-called lizard brain, as you point out, based on a lot of science. I mean, it's a very pervasive model to have held on for so long, if it's really been starting to be debunked as far back as 1970. But the difference you point out is the development, the 270 or so steps from an embryo to a fully grown, fully developed brain, is that there are differing rates of development, and this is kind of gets into more advanced concepts. But one of the things you talk about in the book that I thought was really helpful in terms of development, there's this idea of degeneracy of certain neural pathways, or what some people, I think, call pruning. Can you share with us what that is?
Sure. Actually, degeneracy and pruning are somewhat different concepts. So the concept of degeneracy means that there are multiple ways to produce the same functional outcome. So this is a concept that was, I think, discussed most in depth by the scientist Gerald Edelman, who won a Nobel Prize for immunology. He was an immunologist first and then became a neuroscientist. And what he showed is that almost all biological systems that have ever been studied show degeneracy, which means that there's more than one way to produce a functional outcome. So in genetics, for example, there isn't, for any characteristic that you can think of, with the exception of very few exceptions to what I'm about to say, like maybe the gene for Huntington's chorea. But for the most part, any characteristic of any animal that you can think of, there are multiple sets of genes that can produce that characteristic. Similarly, in the immune system, you have multiple sets of antibodies that can bind with any antigen and vice versa. So you've got basically many ways, not just one, but multiple ways to fight an intruder, like a biological intruder. Your olfactory system works by degeneracy because there are multiple receptors for any given chemical or olfactant, and multiple olfactants can bind to a single receptor. So this sort of many-to-many mapping really is a way of thinking about giving flexibility and robustness to any biological system. The way that I like to describe it is, you know, if you're in London and you need to go from point A to point B, there are lots of different ways to get there because of the way that the tube is set up. You have multiple routes that you can get there. So if one route goes down, you have other routes that you can take to get there. It might take a little longer, but the functionality is still preserved. And so the brain also has degeneracy. This has been shown by Eve Marder. Eve Marder is a neuroscientist who does research in lobsters and crabs. But she's shown that even simple neural circuits for the pyloric sphincter, let's say, in a lobster that, I think it's made up of 9 neurons or something, actually shows degeneracy. That is, different combinations of neurons produce exactly the same function.
Huh. It really is amazing when you cross different species like that. And let's contrast that with pruning. So this is a very important idea that not all of our neurons stay active throughout our lifetimes, but actually in our infancy and childhood, we're constantly pruning and honing our neural networks in order to make our thoughts or our actions or our, you know, involuntary type of actions more efficient.
Yeah, so pruning actually goes on throughout your whole life, but it's most dramatic, I think, in the early years of development. So basically, you know, an infant brain is not a miniature adult brain. It's a brain that's born waiting for a set of wiring instructions from the world. And it's born with many, many more neurons and many, many more synapses than it needs. And what happens is input from the world, both from the physical world, that is, you know, the sights and sounds and smells and so on, that come from the outside world, as well as sense data from inside the infant's own body, and the social world, that is, eye contact that you make with the infant, speaking to the infant, singing to the infant, cuddling the infant, and so on. The sense data will be encoded, or the information will be represented in certain neurons with certain connections, and information that and synapses and so on that are not utilized die back because they're metabolically costly, and if they're not being used, then you don't want to have them hanging around. And actually, failure to prune a brain at the right time or in the right way actually is associated with certain types of illnesses.
Can you say a little bit more about that?
Sure. I mean, I think that there's some research to show that non-neurotypical brains, for example, on the autism spectrum, have an issue with pruning. That is, they're not sufficiently pruned at certain times. And the pruning is important because not only if you have a lot of unused connections that are there, and you have to metabolically maintain them, it's like a metabolic drag on your body budget, essentially. You know, it's like a little tax that you're paying. Mm-hmm. Also, you know, the pruning leaves the way for the connections that are being used to be tuned up and strengthened. And so my understanding, at least the last time I checked, was that there are issues in pruning, I think, with autism spectrum symptoms, and also perhaps, I think, also with schizophrenia, actually, although I'd have to check that because it's been a while since I've had a look at that. But I think in general, these things that we're talking about, tuning and pruning, I mean, one of the ways to think about Alzheimer's disease is that it's pruning. Your brain is basically pruning away neurons it can't afford to support anymore because there's some kind of metabolic illness or a metabolic imbalance or a small metabolic tax that the person has paid over a long period of time. And these taxes are not big. They're tiny little taxes that build up over time, like, you know, water boring a hole through steel. And I think the important thing for physicians to really understand is that, you know, first of all, the problems that you see with pruning, the failure to prune, or at the end of life to over prune, actually not at the end of life, but, you know, starting it actually in middle age, or the problems, these are problems that build up over time. So you don't really start to see symptoms right away. It can be going on for years. This is one reason why, for example, childhood adversity, which is like a metabolic tax on the brain, you know, produces an increase, tremendous increase in likelihood of illness decades later, metabolic illness. And also, when you're thinking about degeneracy, how is that relevant for treating patients? It means that there could be more than one problem, more than one underlying biological problem that is causing symptoms, not the single, that the sort of idea that there's a single biological cause to a single symptom is just probably really wrong.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann. My guest today is Professor Lisa Barrett, who is University Distinguished Professor of Psychology and Neurosciences at Northeastern University. Her brand new book is called 7.5 Lessons About the Brain. And we've talked a lot about brain development, but you point out that there are also these cultural factors. And you alluded to that when we talked about infants and bonding with their parents or learning to read our expressions or hearing sing-song or laughter. And you just mentioned ACEs, adverse childhood experiences, as being functioning essentially like a tax on brain development. You also mentioned poverty, which is in and of itself an adverse childhood event or adverse life event. How does that affect brain development or brain plasticity, as the case may be?
Yeah, so I have to tell you that as I talk about this, I'm going to try really hard just to speak to you as a scientist, but at some point I'm probably going to throw my lab coat off and speak to you as a concerned citizen.
That's okay.
You know, so we live in a culture which makes a distinction between the mind and the body. And so we have mental illnesses and physical illnesses. And everyone is really surprised when there's a mental illness, but it has some kind of physical basis. You know, like immune dysfunction and depression. But actually, depression is a metabolic illness, and it's as much a metabolic illness as diabetes is. Alzheimer's disease is also a metabolic illness. What brings patients to you are psychological symptoms, you know, mood and memory, respectively. But they're both rooted in metabolic problems. I'm not saying that you can reduce everything to a single cause, which is metabolism. I'm saying metabolism plays a big role. The brain's running of the body budget or its failure to allostatically run the body well is a problem that builds up over time. And this is really important to understand because, as I said before, little brains are born under construction. And, you know, a newborn's brain cannot perform allostasis on its own. The baby can't regulate its own temperature. It can't even burp by itself. So, you know, what caregivers are doing is they are basically performing body budgeting functions for the infant, which help the infant's brain wire itself to eventually take over that job on its own. And the brain is getting its wiring instructions from the world. And that includes the physical world and the social world. So if you deprive the infant of those wiring instructions, the brain will wire itself accordingly. And so poverty is a very, very serious limitation on brain development. And the tragedy of it, it's not just poverty. It's not just poverty that an infant lives in. It's poverty that the mother lives in as the embryo and then the fetus is developing. So poverty affects developing fetuses, embryos, and fetuses as well as developing infants. And the tragedy of this. So first of all, I'll just say I don't think there's any question scientifically that this is the case. And certainly it's the case that, you know, some children can be more robust to the effects of poverty than others, but it's a drag on all brain development, on all children who are subjected to growing up in poverty. The National Academies of Sciences put out a report a couple of years ago showing that financially it's actually cheaper to eradicate poverty than it is to pay for the effects of poverty in terms of the illness and the adverse social effects that it produces that show up, you know, a decade or two later when brain development is complete. And so the bottom line is that this is a foreseeable problem. We know enough about the effects of poverty. We don't know everything about the effects of poverty on brain development, but we know enough to know that we are essentially encumbering the brains of the next generation by having children be raised in conditions of poverty. Both the social conditions and the physical conditions of poverty have adverse effects on brain development. And in the United States, we usually hold people accountable for foreseeable harm. Like, you're not allowed to get into a car after you've been drinking too much because there's the foreseeable likelihood that you will harm someone if you're driving under the influence. And so allowing children to brain develop in, you know, under the conditions of poverty is a foreseeable harm.
Yeah, I mean, you said it so well. The National Academy report, I mean, in Tulsa we have a very strong emphasis, actually in the state of Oklahoma, on early childhood education, really by the same argument that the cost of investing in early childhood education has at least a sevenfold return on investment downstream, with diminished costs in terms of the legal system, the healthcare system, and every other. One more question for you. Your previous book, How Emotions Are Made, you had a TED Talk that has been viewed almost 6 million times. And this is a lot to pack into the last question, but you essentially try to teach us that just like our brains are not really so much for thought, but really for maintaining our body systems, that our emotions, we have more control over our emotions than we're led to believe, is how I'll summarize that. Have you had pushback against that response, the idea that people, because you are very clear in saying you can't just control, if you have suffer from depression or anxiety, these are clinical conditions, and it's not something you can just snap out of. But you can, as you say, alter the circumstances to try to optimize yourself for better emotions.
I haven't really received pushback. I think more than anything, what I've received is sort of a tsunami of gratitude. So what maybe there are a lot of people who disagree or who find it problematic, but they're not the ones who are contacting me, I guess. I'm still, you know, How Emotions Are Made has been in print almost 4 years, and I'm not receiving hundreds of emails a day now, but I'm still receiving, you know, a couple each day. Certainly it's more than I can personally answer still. And I guess what I would say is this, that, you know, your brain's most important job is running a budget for your body, and you think and feel and see in the service of running that body budget. You don't experience it that way. I don't experience it that way either, but that's actually what's happening under the hood. And really what your brain is doing is it's using your past experience to allostatically predict and make sense of the sense data that comes to you from your body and from the world in order to make sense of that input, right? So when you feel When you hear a loud bang, for example, what's that? What is that loud bang? What does it mean? Is it someone? Did someone drop something? Did somebody slam a door? Did somebody? Did one car hit another car? Was it a gunshot? What is that loud bang? Your brain is trapped in a dark, silent box called your skull. Your brain doesn't know. It has to make a guess at what that noise meant, so that it knows what to do. Similarly, when your brain is receiving sense data from your body, you experience a tug in your chest. What caused that tug in your chest? Your brain doesn't know. Is it that you're anxious? Is it that you are having trouble breathing? Is it that you have the beginnings of a heart attack? Your brain, or gas even, you know, your brain has to guess. And so where do those guesses come from? They come from your past experience. Your brain uses your past experience in order to make guesses about what sense data means, so your brain knows what to do next. That is how your brain performs allostasis. That's how it does body budgeting. It does it predictively. So your past experiences, you're not conscious of doing this. Your brain is doing it very automatically. So your past experiences are being used to construct your future, which becomes your present. And it's very hard to go back into your past and change your past. You can try to do that with psychotherapy, say. You can try, when your brain is automatically predicting in order to make sense of the sense data coming from your body and from the world. You can try to, with effort, conjure a different prediction. But the quickest and easiest way to change your predictions in the future are to change your experiences right now. So if you change what, if you try to cultivate your experiences right now, you try to change how you're feeling right now, that will essentially seed your brain to predict differently in the future. So in a sense, you could say that you are always cultivating your past in order to change who you will be in the future. And this is a form of responsibility and control. It's a form of control that you have over your actions in the future, and therefore it's, you know, a window, an opportunity to take a little more responsibility for what you feel and what you do, particularly, you know, in circumstances where you're running a body budgeting deficit and your brain is likely to be experiencing, you know, the negative feelings that come from that, which it will make into a negative emotion. And that's the ultimate point of the TED Talk, and I'm not sure that this makes terrific sense in the couple of sentences that I've given you, because in how emotions are made, you know, I took several chapters to basically unpack this, unpack the neuroscience behind it, and then make recommendations for how people can use it productively in their own lives.
Well, the name of the new book is called 7.5 Lessons About the Brain, and it's by my guest today, Professor Lisa Feldman Barrett, who is the University Distinguished Professor of Psychology and Neurosciences at Northeastern University. Lisa Feldman Barrett, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, it's been my pleasure. Thanks so much.
Lisa Feldman Barrett is University Distinguished Professor of Psychology and Neuroscience at Northeastern University in Boston. Her new book is 7.5 Lessons About the Brain. Well, that's our show for this Medical Monday. Studio Tulsa is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of KWGS or the University of Tulsa. For Studio Tulsa, I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. Thanks for listening, and please stay safe out there.